today. So thank you for joining us. You are in the Data-Driven Practice Seminar, which is generally sponsored by Tavistock Books. Thanks for being with us. Hope you didn't get rained on the way in. I'm Emily Hardman, Harvard University, and we have a great panel of presenters to talk to you today. So how we'll manage it is I'll introduce each prior to their talk so that you actually can remember who they are before they start to speak, which is something I always struggle with when they all come at the beginning. And then we'll hold questions to the end so we can really have a conversation that puts all of these presentations kind of together and asks questions and draws out themes that they'll each kind of hit on. And I'd like to start out with just a couple of framing thoughts and questions to pose to you through the course of our session. I just came from giving a workshop at the International Evidence-Based Library Practice Conference in Philadelphia. So that was the whole game of 3 days of talking. And then this morning, in our first talk in the plenary, data were kind of brought up with a pejorative edge. They weren't the stories that we were looking for. So it was a little bit of culture shock. And I'm sure that Valerie uses data in lots of ways in the course of her decision making and has lots of respect for that. But just the way it came out sort of struck this note that made me think of our session for later in the day. And it also reminded me of this bumper sticker that I see around town in Boston. It says, less assessment, more learning. And it's kind of angled at K-12 testing in Massachusetts. But I think we have that in our own domain as well. Even as we're moving toward embracing more of these data-driven, evidence-driven practices, there is some resistance, some concern, I would say, even aggravation maybe, over the demand that special collections and archives really gather more data, write more reports. You know, what does it really matter? And importantly, also I hear this again and again, can't it be used against us? What if we aren't performing in ways that our administration find effective or efficient? What if they compare us to our peers and we're found wanting in some way? There's also a sense of concern that this data collection is an imposition. It's something that we send out in the world, when actually it really reflects what we do, the work that we do, and tells our stories in powerful ways. And will some of us, or maybe I speak for myself alone, be happy to sit with spreadsheets and standard deviation calculations and do some regression analysis? Those analytic outputs are rarely really the point. It's not the data on its own. It's about the data and the evidence, the story-driven practice that we'll talk about today. It's about using what we know about ourselves and our users, our systems and programs, projects to celebrate achievement, to identify areas for improvement, test assumptions, to complicate our existing narratives, to intervene, to grow and to change. And it can be about benchmarking, it can be about bean counting, but when we incorporate these practices in the context of our work with real limitations, staff, budgets, and our real values and real goals, our data-driven practice is about making sure we're on track and moving in the right direction. So we know that assessment work and other associated activities have emerged as increasingly important areas of action, framed particularly by all of the many and varied joint SAA-RBMS task forces, and also locally by these administrative interests and data-driven decision-making practices. And what we want to do in our time together is to think about how we work toward demonstrating what we're experiencing and integrating this work as part of our new business as usual mode on the ground and from a variety of perspectives, public services, technical services, administration. We're going to look at lightweight UX projects and deep ongoing inquiries, and then we'll want to hear from you as well. So some questions for you to keep in mind through the presentations that we might return to in our Q&A time. How do we decide what story to tell with our data? If data are our story, how do we make sure there's fidelity to it so that it's not, like this morning, a true story as remembered by the teller, so that it's really reflecting what we've done? And when many of us are not trained in statistics and analytical work, how will we ensure that we're telling the truth about our data and seeing all the possible stories in it? Who do we communicate with? What does the data need to look like for these different groups that we might be demonstrating our value for or making asks from? And how can we best share the data stories and maybe translate them for a variety of audiences? And as we pay more attention to the numbers, are we setting ourselves up? Will we have to beat our numbers every year? as we keep revisiting assessments, surveys, check marks, spreadsheets? How do we keep from this iteration fatigue? And how do we move from the vague sentiment to the lived experience regarding this fabled culture of assessment? So first we'll hear from Josh. Josh Rowley is the reference archivist for the John W. Hartman Center for Sales, Advertising, and Marketing History in the Rinstein Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Duke University, where he performs reference and instructional services for the collection centers. Josh.
Hi. So the last session I went to, the first speaker confessed that it was her first RBMS, so to a rousing applause. So I'm going to do the same. This is my first RBMS. And in case it's not evident from my choice of neckwear, this is also a bit of a homecoming for me. I'm a graduate of the University of Iowa. I won't give you a year. I'll leave you all in suspense, but we'll take wagers later, see if anybody can guess how old I am. There's a colleague of mine at the Rubenstein Library who gives me grief about being from Iowa. She likes to point out that pigs actually outnumber people in the state of Iowa. So hopefully with y'all in town for RBMS, maybe humans will outnumber pigs in Iowa, at least for a couple of days. So I'm very excited to be here. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a usability assessment that we conducted at the Rubenstein Library beginning in 2015 that moved into, in fact, just this spring. So it was a very long, drawn-out process. Our assessment was a user-focused assessment on our online registration and materials requesting processes. So before I jump into talking about our assessment, I thought I'd talk a little bit about our users. This is a picture of our reading room, our relatively brand new reading room at the Rubenstein Library in Duke. I took this on Friday afternoon before I left for Iowa. It's a very busy spot. I think we have 16 tables in there, and they were nearly all full. So a very, very, very busy place. Hopefully there's nothing incriminating in that photo, no pens on the table or anything. Here are some statistics concerning our users. We get about almost 3,800 visitors a year. Those are not unique visitors. Those include return visitors, but still a very busy place. Distributed in that bar graph throughout the year. No surprise, we're really busy in like peak semester seasons. And below, it shows our user distribution. And we serve almost 35% undergraduates. So we cater a lot to our undergraduate users. So in August of 2012, we shifted our registration and materials requesting processes online. We did use Aon to facilitate this move, but Aon is so integrated into our local environment that it was probably more accurately described as a web usability assessment than it is any particular tool. So I'll try to avoid using the A word from here on out. When planning this move, we were mostly concerned with just getting everything to work and meeting our deadline for our go live date. So we certainly considered the user's perspective, but we mostly just wanted everything to work. And it did. We had no formal data gathering process for the 3 years leading up to this assessment. Most of what we knew about our users' experience, we heard anecdotally through interactions with them in the reading room or the reference area, but we didn't compile that in any way, and we really didn't do anything about it. There was nothing actionable. So we decided to assess. I was tasked by David Pavlich, the former head of Rubenstein Library Research Services, to lead a small group of people to assess this process. That was me, a member of Research Services, Sarah Carrier, who is now a North Carolina collection librarian at UNC's Wilson Library, and a cataloger from Technical Services, Jessica Janecki. We decided in the very early stages that we wanted some live usability testing coupled with a broad assessment sent to a lot of users. We took our user experience slash interaction with these processes and divided them up into logical components So registration, requesting, and people's interactions or utilization of their online accounts. And I'm only really going to be talking about the registration and requesting usability tests today, and those not even in every minute detail. We fleshed out some tasks that exposed what we thought likely confused our researchers based on our own experience and our own frustrations with the system. We asked them through a series of tasks to interact with all parts of those websites. The usability test was given to our assessment and user experience department, where they polished it into a really nice, clean set of tasks. We were lucky enough to have an assessment usability department at Duke that we could turn to for expertise and guidance. The first test was a pop-up test, and that essentially amounts to setting up a table, like a $30 folding table, outside the coffee shop in the Duke's libraries. A high traffic area. There's a facilitator and a participant and a series of tasks on that piece of paper next to her. This isn't actually our assessment, but you get the idea. And a sign-up sheet where very minimal information about the participant is documented. And they're offered an incentive of free coffee, maybe a cookie. It's relatively cheap. Emily Daly, who is head of our assessment and user experience department, says she has never spent more than $20 on one of these, which seems like a lot of money for just coffee, but yeah, that's just me. So these were conducted in February of 2015. I did attend them, so I kind of awkwardly milled around the table, which is probably not a good idea. I recommend not going to these, but it was very informative. Kids these days use very foul language when speaking to adults. And there were also some very interesting and funny anecdotes, which I'll get to perhaps. Our particular test was conducted by Emily, and at that time a current intern from the SILS program at UNC Chapel Hill, Jackie Wilkinson. So some of the questions we wanted looked at during that pop-up were, do people see this login button on our homepage? Where you log into your account or create an account, or if they see it, do they even care, and do they primarily use the My Accounts link, which is at the top of our library's banner, and that appears on every website, every library website you encounter. So we sort of assume that people would likely use that one. This will require a little bit of explanation. Every user encounters this page. This is what we kind of call the splash page. We have a shared user table with UNC Chapel Hill, meaning if you register at one institution, you're automatically registered as a researcher at the other. So researchers at both places, Wilson Library at UNC and the Rubenstein at Duke, all encounter this particular page. So we wanted to know how people might be interpreting this page, if it made any sense, people knew where to sign in, etc. And finally, do people read our first-time user registration agreement? Which you can see contains many, many words. But there's very important words in here, like things like access restrictions, copyright, reading room regulations, and our disclaimer that basically shifts responsibility for how you use our stuff to the researcher. And there's actually a second page. I couldn't fit it all on one. And there's that I agree button that people click at the bottom. So participants were given prompts. The first one was, an instructor has asked you to register with the Rubenstein Library as a researcher. One student said, when given this task, like, so what do you do? Your professor has asked you to register as a researcher. What next? He said, I'll click Ask a Librarian. I always click Ask a Librarian, which is my favorite quote perhaps of all time. And access your new account from anywhere, so from any library website, and go to your new account from the Rubenstein Library homepage, hoping that if we directed them to the homepage, they would find that login button. These tests were followed by a series of questions, mostly general questions, but also some specific questions about particular pages, tasks, or decisions that the participant made. Feedback was received in formal reports put together by AUX. That summarized the test, described the participants in general terms, and listed key findings and offered recommendations for possible changes. There were 7 total students that participated in this, 5 undergraduates and 2 graduates. The graduate students had a far more thoughtful approach to these tasks, not surprisingly. So the test was also distributed to our Graduate Student Library Advisory Board, which was over 10 graduate students, so we got feedback from them as well. What we learned, the login button is relatively easy to spot. Students expect integration across all library accounts, so ILL, Rubenstein, and our circulating collections. Most participants use the all accounts link, which there's not much of a surprise there. There was some confusion about the multi-institutional splash page that we share with UNC. People thought that you would log in where you wanted to look at collections, so if you wanted to go to Wilson, you'd sign in using the UNC login. Undergraduates did not read the first-time user registration page. They immediately scrolled and clicked, "I agree." That also is not terribly surprising. While AUX was preparing these reports, we started to plan a more involved, lengthier, and fully observed test, usability test. So we started thinking about things like recruitment, incentives, and number of participants. We chose 5 participants. We offered them a $10 Amazon gift card, which our department paid for. We also paid a 33% gift tax on that because, never mind, I'm not going to go there. But just keep that in mind. If you want to offer incentives for any kind of initiative, just keep in mind someone's going to have to pay taxes on it. It was certainly a challenge trying to identify 5 people to serve as proxies for a very large, diverse group of researchers that visit our library, all of whom come to us with varying degrees of experience at these kinds of places, and definitely a varying degree of comfort with online systems or even the internet. We chose 2 novice users, so 2 people that have never used a special collections library, 2 experienced users who have used the Rubenstein Library's collections, and kind of a wild card, so 1 person that has visited other special collections libraries, but never ours, who might think that they know a lot about what they're doing. So that was a perspective we were keen to capture. Participants included a staff member from the hospitals, a postdoc in business, a graduate student in history, a 3rd-year undergrad public policy major, and a 1st-year undecided major. So the tests were conducted in a lab, so to speak, in our IT department, where, again, they were joined by a facilitator. This isn't actually an image of our arrangement, but it was close enough. And there's actually a mirror where observers can sit and watch the person walk through these tests in real time. These tests were actually recorded by a software called Moray, so that captures everything they're doing on the screen, it captures audio, and it actually records their face too, because the face actually tells you a lot about how people really feel, even if they might not know how to say it or might feel bad about saying it. So each test took about 35 to 45 minutes, depending on the experience level of the participant. And they were provided a dummy account login so they could actually completely request items. Some of the things we wanted to take a closer look at were do people see this request for on-site use button in our collection guides? And when that button is clicked, you're actually dumped into our OPAC. Dumped is a little harsh. You're taken to our OPAC. You cannot request material directly from our collection guides for reasons I won't get into now. So you're taken to the catalog record. And how collections are displayed in our style sheet and our collection guides versus the catalog is very, very, very different. So we assume people are probably confused about those differing displays, but we didn't really have any concrete evidence to prove that. And lastly, we have no batch request option. Every box has to be requested individually. Each box opens as a separate tab in the researcher's browser, which annoys everyone pretty much. But again, we wanted to find out for sure. So tasks, request a box from a specific collection from its guide. So participants were provided a link to that particular guide. Request boxes 6 and 7 from this collection, and request those from its catalog record. So you can see from this display, which is something very unique to us probably, you can't see boxes 6 and 7. It goes from box 1 to 10, and then, yeah. So once somebody clicks request, there are a couple places where you can click requests. You're actually taken to yet another screen. You haven't actually requested anything yet, where it again displays the boxes in a third unique way, and this is inverse numerical order. So we assume that that was probably irritating to some people. And if you're sign in as an other user, meaning an unaffiliated user, you land on a page like this, which is pretty bland. And if you're a new user, there's actually an option way down there in the lower left-hand corner where you can create a new account, and it's not exactly apparent that that button is there. So feedback, two people hesitated clicking the request for on-site use button from the guide for fear that they would request the entire 100 boxes or whatever from the collection. We had lots of comments about the usability of the guides themselves, which we were trying to avoid, but it's very useful. It actually prompted another usability test of our guides. So those have been completely redesigned. Everyone expects the ability to request multiple boxes from the same collection at the same time. And not surprisingly, again, there was general irritation with the confusion in the catalog. So we moved on from this more involved usability test to a survey, which we distributed in December of last year. We hoped the survey would reach more people, and probably, hopefully anyway, a more representative group of our users. We hope to get some reinforcing feedback. So if we did decide to make certain changes, it wasn't based on the feedback of one or two people. It could potentially be based on the feedback of 15 to 20 to 50, who knows. The survey mirrored in a lot of ways the two usability tests. We wanted to keep it relatively short, so hopefully somebody could finish it in 10 minutes or less. And again, with some serious, serious help from our assessment librarian, Joyce Chapman, we had a polished survey built. We used Qualtrics to build and distribute the survey. She also helped us mine our user table for a distribution pool. So we chose everyone that signed into the reading room for the first time within a selected 90-day period. That 90-day period was strategically chosen to sort of overlap the summer months when we get a lot of visiting researchers and the fall when we tend to get a few more students. The survey was distributed on December 16th with a reminder sent in early February. Our email reached 536 users. Our response rate was about 25%. And we also did more targeted distribution of the survey on an iPad so we could actually select people to give the survey to. I'll show you just a couple, some of the reporting from that survey. I won't go through all of the questions. So we had a pretty even distribution in terms of our respondents. I'm surprised at the number of undergraduates that responded. A lot of people that identified as others were, in fact, probably could be categorized in one of the other groups, but that's okay. We asked how often they visit special collections libraries just to get a sense of their experience level. And we asked them how much of the first time user registration page they read. Most people don't read it. A majority of people read less than half, which is not good. But again, that was not a big surprise. And again, no surprise, the adults, the faculty, read the whole thing, almost to 100%. We also asked people how they were interpreting process statuses of their requests. I didn't talk about our test of the online account. Mostly I wanted to include the slide because it's very pretty, lots of cool colors. But Aon comes with process statuses so people can actually track where their request is in terms of submission, to it's being pulled, to it's on hold, etc. We have a remote storage facility called the Library Service Center. nobody knows what the LSC is. In-item retrieval was also confusing to people, so that was something to consider because Aon does allow you to change these queue names. So we then got together, culled all of this data from the formal reports we got from AUX, our survey, and looked for common themes and responses that were hopefully within our power to change. And for larger, more complex issues, like some of the catalog issues, we at least had data to say, users don't like this. If possible, hopefully we can fix these. We then put together a formal proposal and sent it to our WebEx group, which is a library-wide committee that is dedicated to the web experience of our users. The proposal was approved, and after nearly 2 years of work, mock-ups were created. We approved them. We made some small changes. Final pages were published in about 2 weeks. So it was a bit of kind of an anticlimax after almost 2 years of work to have all the work done in 2 weeks. I kind of felt bad about that, actually. But the changes we made, I'm really happy with. So this is the old splash page. So people were confused a little bit about where to log in. People also gave us some feedback on the aesthetics of the page, particularly this gray area up here, which one person referred to as disturbing. And people were also put off somewhat by the barber poles. I thought they'd like candy canes, but barber poles will work. So this is the new page, the new refresh page. So we got rid of the puzzle pieces, the disturbing gray void. There was some logic to leaving that as a gray void, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So this is the new page. Hopefully it's more obvious where people sign in. So it's clear that Duke, you sign with your Net ID, UNC, you sign in with your Onion. And we also made the other or unaffiliated researchers login a bit more prominent. And we also got rid of the designation all others. And our library banner is at the top now. This is the unaffiliated users login page. And again, that first time users link down there is hard to see. So this is what it looks like now. We moved that up to the top. We got rid of first-time user registration and just cut that down to first-time. We also got rid of the term username because in our installation of Aon, when you create an account with us, your email address is automatically your username. So we just got rid of the term username altogether. The first-time user registration page, we really trimmed down. We did do this in cooperation with UNC. All the language is improved by our librarian for scholarly communications and our leadership team. So we didn't just do this on a whim. It took some time. So they're now very easy to spot headers for access copyright and our disclaimer. And rather than spelling out reading room regulations, we now link to those respective websites. The request for on-site use button, it's brown, and there's a weird box thing there. I think that's a box. No one has ever really figured out what that is. It's now green, which matches the color of the request button in our catalog. And just really quickly, this is a view of what patrons would see when they log into their online account. And there's a menu bar on the left. And it looks like it's collapsible. Some of the terminology is a little strange. Like history requests, for instance. So we refresh that page. All these pages now look like they belong to Duke. They look like Duke Library websites, which is very nice. And we reordered and changed the name of some of those request links. So history requests is now past requests. They also appear in a bit more logical order. So I swear I was going to use the word tidbits right now in my talk before this morning. So I'm going to offer just a few tidbits in case you're thinking about doing an assessment of your own. I would recommend condensing your timeline just a little bit. taking as long as we did certainly had its benefits. There were no impulsive decisions. We had plenty of time to analyze the data and not working up against some deadline that we set ourselves. We had a lot of flexibility. But by the time we pulled the survey down, it really did feel like it had been a year and a half since we did the pop-ups. So going back and refamiliarizing yourself with all that feedback was a bit of a task. I do think this is scalable. You don't need all of these resources that Duke has at its fingertips. The pop-up test and even the more involved fully observed test, I think, can be replicated at smaller institutions. It's literally a folding table and a laptop, and maybe somebody that might read a little bit about being a good facilitator. I don't know what that might take, but I'm sure that there's information out there. Overall, we are very happy with the changes we've implemented. We're already talking about, like, where does this stop? Because I feel like we've invested all this time and all this energy into these changes, and what if they're terrible? I'd like to know that, but that's it for now. So thank you. I really appreciate, again, the opportunity to be here. So thank you.
Moira Fitzgerald is the head of access services at Beinecke Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Yale. In this role, she oversees the frontline services for reading room and remote patrons, classroom support, and stacks management. In her 9 years at Yale, she's managed Beinecke's transition from a paper-based tracking system to a homegrown database to their Aon implementation in 2011. So, thanks.
Thanks, Emily. Thanks, everyone, for coming today. So in my talk today, I'd like to discuss efforts I've been making over the past 6 years to gather data from systems outside the library, specifically our course management system. The approach I'd like to take is to sort of talk about, as someone who is interested in data and has been working with it for several years, I've been responsible for collecting our public services statistics, as Emily mentioned, in a number of different ways. And I enjoy it, but I don't have any formal training in data analysis or technical training. So I talked to you about what I did, what mistakes I made, what went well, what didn't, what I've learned, and what I think the potentials are for our profession, and I hope to generate discussion with other people who may be interested in doing this work or have done similar work already. So adventures and misadventures. So like a lot of reading rooms out there, we can get numbers for you if you want them. This is some of what we track, not everything, but patrons, we have reading room visits. We have unique patrons. We can do that by status. We can do it by day and month of the visit. We're tracking first-time visits. For classes, we have instructors. We have dates they came. We have the departments. We have types like semester-long and non-EL groups. We're doing the number of attendees per class. We're basically entering that number in based on a rough count of who's shown up or the number that the professor gives us. And you can do a lot with that. This is a nice slide we were able to do with just a number of, using the course numbers, we were able to figure out how many courses from each department were coming in this year. That was useful. But there's a lot we don't know. Reading room patrons, particularly for the Yale community, we don't know the class year, we don't know the majors, we don't know the course assignments that are bringing them into the library. For classes, there's a lot we don't know. We don't really know about we don't keep good statistics about who's teaching them. Sometimes it's a librarian. Sometimes we have faculty members who just teach without a staff member in the room. Sometimes we have graduate students who teach. I should say we average over 500 sessions a year, so it's very hard to sort of do much beyond just getting some general information about the class. We've talked about having students register individually. With that many students, it would overwhelm our service desk. We've also talked about having a card swipe in the room. There's technical barriers to that. So we don't have good data on, you know, unique versus returning classroom attendees, the class year, if they're graduate or undergraduate students, the majors, and then we also don't really know who's not coming in. There's a whole universe of the university who don't walk through our doors. They may use our digital services, but in terms of reading room, we have no idea who's coming in and who's not. We have some idea who's coming in, we don't really know who's not coming in. So you see here sort of an interesting line graph. The top is our reading room visits, and the blue on the bottom is classroom visits. And so as you can see, since 2012, we've seen a lot of increase in classroom, while reading room has stayed kind of the same. That dip you see in 2015, 2016 was during our renovation when we had limited hours and limited services. And we've been ramping up since we reopened in September. And interestingly, that number is almost converged right now. So the top line, we know that represents basically 2,000 and change unique reading room visitors. We know a lot about them. We don't know much, as I said, about the bottom line, the blue line there. And we don't know where they overlap, how much of an overlap there is here. So those are questions I had. And I didn't really know how to get at that. I couldn't think of it, think of a way to do that. Until last fall, I attended ARL's Library Assessment Conference in Washington, D.C. And I was it was a great conference, and I saw a presentation from two librarians from Tufts and one from University of New Hampshire. So Erica Shaddle and Josh Kwan from Tufts University and Megan Breshnahan from University of New Hampshire presented on how they had used student data collected by the university to tell them how many students were getting library instruction sessions and how many were getting multiple sessions. So they could tell of the students who were enrolled in a certain class how many had been enrolled in one of the prerequisites to that class and if they'd had a library instruction session. That presentation is online if you go to the ARL website. And it was interesting to me, they're not from a special collections background, but they seem to have gotten answers, the same answers that I really wanted to know. So I started talking to them a little bit, and I am grateful for them for their being willing to give me some advice on this. And I started looking at different tools that might be available. So student information systems, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, this is software to manage student data. They're widely used by colleges and universities. They track a lot of information, demographic information, course enrollment, grades, financial information, admissions records, transcripts, majors. A few examples are Banner and Oracle. But obviously access to them is sensitive, as it should be. There's the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and also institutional policies that makes access to that data very restricted, which I think we all agree is a good idea. In addition to that, there's their course management systems. So this is software that provides online environment for classroom interactions. This includes syllabus, assignments, course discussion board or chat. And many times these fields are, the information about the students is populated from the student information system. Some examples are Blackboard, Desire to Learn, Moodle, Sakai, Canvas. The barrier to this access may be easier. A lot of librarians already have roles in these softwares as embedded librarians or course reserve staff. There's less information there. It's much smaller portion of what the university collects. It can be difficult to get that information out for any kind of data project that you want to do. And it's also, for my purposes, when you're talking about students who are attending classes, it's going to have the students who are enrolled in that class, but not necessarily the ones who showed up that day. However, in our environment at Yale, unlike maybe when I was undergraduate, we do kind of assume that students are going to most of their classes, and that class attendance is not a problem the way it may have been for other schools. For others of us, I won't go into more detail there. So I started asking questions, and I found out that Yale is actually transitioning from course management systems transitioning from a Sakai platform, which is open source, to something called Canvas, which is by a company called Instructure. The student information there is populated by our student information system, Banner. And I was able to request and get access to both of these systems. So Classes V2, which is Sakai, has course rosters, course numbers, and students' names and their net IDs, which is basically their username for most of their accounts on campus. So it's usually their initials plus a random number, and they use it to log into everything, and it's unique per student. And then I also got access to the current system, the one we're in the process of transitioning to, which is called Canvas. And again, course rosters, student names, and net IDs. Their major and their class year. And what was also nice about Canvas is that every Yale course has a site, whether the instructor uses it or not. So basically, even if the instructor decides not to use that system, they still create a course site with the course roster. To do this, I did have to fill out some paperwork and basically promise not to disclose any of the information, which is, of course, appropriate. And that was all I had access to. I didn't have access to grades or anything like that. So what I was able to do was basically download a spreadsheet from two different places. So I went to our patron database, and I downloaded a spreadsheet that had the net ID, which we collect as part of our process, and the date of their registration. And I got this from Aon, but it I downloaded it into Excel, and so if you had a spreadsheet with this information, it could have come from anywhere. And then I downloaded from our current course management system, Canvas, for each course, or I attempted to do this, for each course that I knew came to bind a key, I tried to download the same thing, the NetID and the major and the course number. And my idea was that I would be able to sort of join those two spreadsheets on the NetID because that was a unique field in both the spreadsheets. And I wanted to use some sort of data visualization software to help me with this. There are a lot out there, and I actually defer to our moderator, Emily Hardman, who has a lot of experience, who could talk about this a little more. Microsoft Power BI is one. It's free. Tableau is another one that is not free but has a public version. And you can connect it. You can upload spreadsheets to either one and do some interesting things with charts. And it can also help you sort of analyze the data that you have. So I was very excited to do this, and I immediately went gung-ho into it. And downloaded about 40 course lists for about 40 sessions. That was less than 10% of what we do in a year. And I quickly realized that was insane and it was not going to work. There was no way I was going to be able to do that. It was just not going to work. So I decided to start a little smaller. And I turned to a course that we've been well known to us at BindKey for a while, the English 125, Major English Poets from Chaucer to Donne. So this is the first required course of the English major. It has a set curriculum. They read Chaucer, Edmund Spenser, William Shakespeare, and John Donne. It's a pretty small class taught by a tenured faculty member. So the idea is that the students who are mostly freshmen who are already English majors or plan to be English majors have an opportunity to be taught by a senior faculty member. And beginning in the fall of 2013, we started hosting every section. So in 2013, that was 7 sections, 80 students over the course of the week, and we showed them about 20 relevant early printed works and manuscripts. Our goals for doing this at the time, before this, some of the instructors would contact us for sessions and some wouldn't. So, and the ones that did would often want to show different things. So the curator, Catherine James, responsible for the early modern period, reached out to them and pitched this idea of having a set list and having all the sections come in over the course of a week and a half, and just sort of doing this marathon classroom sessions where they and different people would help teach them. And it would sort of be to standardize the list, to get all the sections in, and also as a form of outreach to the faculty who weren't always coming in with their sessions or didn't think to contact us. But that said, there are also a lot of logistical challenges. There's a lot of preparation time, both on the part of the instructor and also the staff who were preparing the materials and making them available, scheduling, and then an area that we're becoming increasingly concerned is the intensive use of materials over a relatively short period of time. Now those students, that first cohort has recently graduated, and I was wondering if these students ever came and used the reading room. So, I was able to export the course list for each section. I combined them into one spreadsheet. I exported a list of all the readers who registered after July 1st, 2013, just because there were so many records that it wasn't possible. It would have been too large a group. And I uploaded both to Microsoft Power BI, and I joined the two spreadsheets on that NetID field. And what I got was something that looked like this. On the right, you see usernames of students who were enrolled in that class, and on the left you see if they had a corresponding account in our special collection system. And when I looked at that, I saw that, and the total of people who actually ever came during the course of their 4 years at Yale was about 38%. So when I looked at that and I saw it in this way, I saw those spaces on the side and I realized I had some information about people who weren't coming in. And I realized that I also had some information about who had taken the class and if they had ever, and when they'd come back. So I was actually able to figure out, one person came within a week, a few had already come before the session, which was in October. And then of the ones that came again, most of them came back within a year. So that made me, I was interesting. I wasn't surprised to learn that, not all of them came back. That wasn't because I've known for a while that the increase in classroom attendance didn't really correspond to the increase in readership in the reading room. But it was interesting to have numbers and to look at, sort of follow what happened after that from a distance a little bit. But it made me wonder about another class, the English 114. This is an introduction to college writing. It's generally taught by graduate students and adjunct faculty. The topic varies per section. It's basically, it's just a writing course. The attended audience is non-English majors who may want to take an English course. It's also heavily marketed to STEM majors. It's a common way for them to fulfill their writing requirement. It's also marketed to non-English speakers. Also, any of the cohorts that come in the summer, like our first-generation college students, any individual who may, for some reason, need some extra guidance in adjusting to life at Yale is encouraged to take this class. It has a very large enrollment. It's 50 sections are offered every year, 30 in the fall. And the interesting thing is each section is required to have a class session with a librarian in the Sterling Memorial Library, in our circulating library. And this is a very basic overview of library catalog, databases. And there's some discussion of special collections. I'm one of the people that volunteered to teach in this program because they have so many sections they need some help. And I do talk about it, but there's certainly no materials involved, and it's really not the point of the sessions as they're currently designed. So this is a class that, and occasionally every semester we have one or two instructors that do ask to come to Beinecke, but it's not a group that we've really done any outreach to for a lot of reasons. But so I was curious that, and I went to the fall of 2013 and I saw again 300 students, about 30 sections, but what was nice is it was all in one list. So I could get just one list. And I noticed that in that year there was one section that did come to Beinecke at the request of that professor. And so again, I ran some numbers. I did this by section. Section 8 was the one that came to Beinecke, and you can see, so basically the blue is the enrollment and the orange is the number that actually came to Beinecke. And not surprisingly, it was a much lower number, 16%. About a third actually visited a special collections at Yale, which was encouraging. Again, not particularly surprising, but it was interesting to compare the two groups and to actually have numbers to sort of validate what we already sort of suspected. So going from that, in those two instances, I started with a class, a specific course number, and it was a class where I kind of knew the profile, I knew the attended audience. I don't know exactly how many of the students in English 125 actually became English majors, and I don't know exactly the majors of the ones who took English 114, except they probably weren't English majors. But it was sort of an interesting start, and I decided to move from that into going to beyond that and seeing if I could figure out more information. So I started with... because we have so many classes, I started with the week of March 26th, which is one of our busiest weeks. We had about 20 Yale classes, about 185 classroom visits. And when I downloaded that list and then did a deduping, I realized that was basically 173 unique students that came that week. I was able to do a breakdown of undergraduates and graduate students and identify that two students had three classes that week. They were graduate students in medieval studies and music. And eight students came twice that week. And that was... medieval studies, history, religious studies, and undeclared. So those are three of the majors. And five of those courses were taught by graduate students. It was quite a bit of work to do that, but it was manageable, at least. And I also was able to identify courses where there was overlap. So the ones on the left, no surprise that the individuals enrolled in those courses would be somewhat similar. But on the right, those are undergraduate courses. And there were students enrolled who actually ended up coming twice that week that were freshmen and juniors. So. And going back to that first attempt that I tried where I quickly abandoned, I ended up going back to that later and trying to get a little more information about, so basically of those, 40 classes, I was able to get some information about, so that was 90%, 9% of the number of classes we had the entire year, 600 classroom visits, but 540 unique students, so about 10% of that had come in, and then about 116 came twice during that time. And then I was able to get information about the majors. Because this is such a small amount, and I don't know how much it represents the entire year, that's one of the challenges with this. But I was able to make a nice word cloud of all the majors, and was happy to see undeclared a big one, because that usually indicates early career undergraduates. So what, right? I spent a lot of time, and I got data, some of which was not surprising. And are we going to do anything to change based on this data? We are looking at English 125, particularly from the point of view of the materials usage that it engenders, and seeing if, and the work that is involved. It is a great program. We know that we can't assume English majors are coming into Beinecke, and maybe this is a great way to do it. Maybe it's entirely okay that that's their only experience, and that's fine too. These are all questions we just have to ask ourselves in terms of what is the goal. In terms of English 114, I can say unequivocally we are not really staffed to have 30 sections come in to do a hands-on material session, but maybe there are ways, particularly considering they already have a library session, where we could incorporate talking about special collections a little bit more. Using these numbers to say, well, where do we want to go as an institution? Who do we want to target our outreach for? Knowing that we have very limited resources and staff to do we really want to reach everybody, or are there certain groups where it makes more sense? This is information that obviously as an institution we have to consider. It is true that our universities are collecting a lot of data. Some of it could be quite relevant, but obviously there are privacy concerns. But there is the potential for more targeted outreach. I would argue that it's also, the more you know about who's coming into your classes, the better. So it's nice to say that we have 7,000 something class visits a year, but how many people is that really, and where are they coming from, and how many people are coming in multiple times, and can we do something with that data, is that useful? I would also mention the importance of collaboration. I talk to a lot of people outside of special collections, outside the library world. I work at a large institution. I don't know anyone in the registrar's office. They don't know me. But after I'd had this experience with the course management software, and I sort of felt like I knew what pieces of data I might want to see from that wasn't, that I could just have a report of, for example, all the freshmen that were in certain majors. And I actually asked them that, and to my surprise, they didn't say no right away. They're considering it, and I may be able to do that. I don't know yet. But I feel like this is worth exploring. I would also say if you're thinking about doing something like this, it's okay if you don't really know the question you want to answer. I think just seeing what you can find out and seeing if anything stands out to you as a surprise or perhaps a justification of something you knew all along, but at least you have now some numbers behind it. So I found this whole experience very illuminating for me in terms of figuring out what's reasonable, and also it's shown me, at least from my perspective, that it's really hard, even with the systems that were with under the library's domain, to get information out that we want. And this includes Aon, but there are others out there as well. My whole career has basically been, I've seen it's always been very difficult to get information in a format where you can really digest it. And I wanted to end on a picture of one of our undergraduate students, Eve Houghton, who some of you may recognize. Eve was one of those, among that cohort of freshmen 2013 in English 125 who became an English major and sort of got the special collections bug. And she quickly she started having other more of her classes came to Beinecke, and she became the student employee of one of our curators. And she basically just got that spark. And I wanted to end with her because, yes, numbers are important, but of course it's not always about numbers. She came into that class and got interested, asked questions, became very involved, and was nice enough to sit with me and talk with me when I was preparing this and sort of talk about her as she was reflecting, having just graduated, and she's going to start her PhD program at Yale in the fall and is interested in curatorial work. She was talking about the impact of being able to come into Beinecke and do research hands-on as an undergraduate. And she's said that the library is one of the main reasons I decided to stay at Yale for my PhD. It's been much as an institutional home for me as the English department. And she also said, she was talking about her, about long-term engagement. She said, I feel pretty strongly that all special collections teaching should involve some form of independent work, even if it's just setting aside half an hour in class to make a transcription or take notes on their own. Seminar format can, of course, be wonderful, but encountering an object in a group with an instructor present just doesn't come close to the actual conditions of research. I think if it feels like a museum visit, isn't all that surprising that undergraduates treat it that way, as a fun, interesting experience, but not as a vital intellectual project. And that's sort of interesting to me because it's sort of, wondering what the goal was of the instruction programs that we have, and just sort of thinking that way and perhaps challenging some assumptions. But anyway, and she was very nice to let me use this picture of her as well. So many thanks to her. So thank you.
Carrie Hintz, the head of collection services at Emory University's Stuart Rose Manuscripts, Archives, and Rare Books Library, where she oversees the digital archives program, manuscript processing, rare book cataloging, and collection management functions for the library. Prior to Emory, she served as the head of archives processing at Columbia University's Rare Books and Manuscripts Library. She holds an MSI in Archives and Records Management from University of Michigan, and an MA in American Studies from Columbia University. Carrie's particularly interested in developing and managing, importantly, sane, efficient, data-driven, and standards-based technical services programs and special collections. And then we have Jennifer Meehan, who serves as the Associate Director of the Stuart Rose Manuscript Archives and Rare Books Library at Emory, in which role she oversees the administrative, collection services, research services, and university archives units of the Rose Library. Prior to this position, she held positions at Yale University, the Smithsonian Institute, and Virginia Tech. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Jennifer. This is Carrie. It's nice to have a co-presenter because we don't have to make the long, lonely walk to the podium by ourselves. And it's a longer walk than usual today. So thank you all for being here. In our talk, we'll be shifting gears a little bit to focus on some of the more programmatic aspects of data-driven practice, especially in and around technical services. So from our different perspectives, Carrie's as a frontline manager, mine as an administrator, we'll discuss the data that we use in our work of assessment, decision-making, planning, and reporting. And this data includes holdings metrics, processing and cataloging metrics, as well as public services metrics. These are the numbers that really serve to quantify the what of our collections and our work. We're also going to discuss how we put that data to use. In essence, how we translate it for different purposes, turning our numbers about what we hold and what we do into stories about why it's important, or to pose the question the way Maura asked it, so what? So I'm going to hand things over to Carrie at this point, and then I'll step back in later to share further thoughts.
So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about how Jennifer and I partner to do this work of translation, of collecting the data and then turning it into some kind of organizational change. So like many of you, we do a lot of counting. We count numbers of collections, linear footage, we count shelf space, used and available. We count the feet that are processed or accessioned and books cataloged. We count our users and their requests. So we gather a lot of numbers, but we haven't always been great about using them. We report out, but what do we do with them? So over the past few years, inspired by the broader field's focus on and energy around assessment, we've been really intentional about not only gathering this data, but using it to inform our practice and to drive change. We've helped to drive a shift in our unit from simply collecting these numbers to thinking programmatically about them, about building a culture of assessment where we, as a matter of course, engage in data-driven decision-making and using evidence to communicate our value. And we focus that in three key areas, and using data to make decisions, to advocate for our needs, and to translate that data into more meaningful stories about the value of our work and the impact that it has on others. So for decision-making, we all use data every day to inform our decisions, right? Our approaches to our work, looking at things like our common lightweight tasks, our common everyday tasks, using data to make decisions about those is a really lightweight, non-resource intensive way to use that data. There are things that are usually internalized that we have control over. We don't need to make a lot of asks. So that is one place where we can operationalize that pretty quickly. So example in processing. Describing our collections is one of the most important things that we do as special collections professionals. It's also one of the most time-consuming and expensive. Processing and cataloging are activities that, even in the best of circumstances, tend to take a lot of time, and we only have the staff and the capacity to do so much. So we want to make sure that that time and that intellectual capital are being well spent. And that means that they're being spent on projects that are going to have an actual impact and matter to people. So this potential for impact in the form of demonstrated user demand is one of the top criteria we consider when we're making our processing decisions. In our shop, it's standard practice that as soon as a collection comes in the door, it gets accessioned and then it's available to researchers. And so it's immediately available for use. So we have pretty robust user statistics even on our unprocessed collections. So we have a really clear record of what our researchers are using, what collections are in demand, what people want. So we can combine that with factors such as institutional priorities like exhibitions that may be coming up. And these use statistics and accompanying researcher feedback that we receive from our research services staff act as a roadmap for setting the processing priorities that will actually result in high value for our users.
Another thing that we have recently started doing is using technical services metrics in to help drive some of our collecting and collection development, which is, I think, a little bit unusual. However, new collections can have significant operational impact. They're really dependent on technical services resources, such as accessioning them, shipping them, storing them. So we have started working on an operational impact statement for new collections coming in the door that lets us as technical services staff communicate out to the curatorial staff and the administration what it means to bring in this collection, what it means to bring in that, you know, 200 linear feet of material and what kind of impact that's going to have, to help them take that into consideration when making collecting decisions. Making the case. So while we have a good deal of control over how we leverage our statistics and metrics to make internal decisions and manage projects and priorities, there are often times when meeting unit goals requires making a case to administrators or other stakeholders for things like more resources, maybe staff or space to do the work the way that we want to do it, or to do it more effectively. For us in the Rose, these sorts of cases are where Jennifer and I tend to do the most coordinating and partnering, and where we really focus not only on the data that we gather, but how we spin that into different kinds of stories that will communicate to our different audiences, because we need things from those audiences. So I think I speak for all of us in this room when I say that staffing levels or available staff skills are often the biggest barriers we face to doing our work effectively or to jump-starting new projects. So I'm going to give two quick examples of how we've recently made the case, either for new staff or for modifying certain staff lines, because we had the evidence to demonstrate our needs, develop a compelling fact-based case, and concretely project the anticipated impact and benefits of those staffing changes. So we're the only ones I know, but our print cataloging backlog is a little big. And people have long understood that it's a problem, it's sort of this elephant in the room, it's a big print cataloging backlog. But we've never really known quite how big it is. We don't know what it would take to address it, or even really how to go about trying to quantify it, which is one area that I'm really excited about the new Joint Task Force metrics that are coming out on holdings counts. Which will provide us a standardized way to communicate the size of our collection, to understand its growth within our institution, and to compare against other institutions. Unfortunately, for the level one counts that are currently out and up for comment, those only look at things that are already described or cataloged, so it doesn't help with a backlog assessment project like this. But it's still something that will probably be addressed in the level two document, and that I'm very much looking forward to. But anyway, our rare book cataloger and I undertook a count of our linear footage and approximate number of volumes that we had in our backlog. And we used that to sort of start to think about how to build a case for additional cataloging support. So I turned to Jennifer and I gave her all my numbers, a little memo. It was very pretty, very compelling. But one of the things that I also did was put in at the end, not just those numbers, but I looked at what our normal cataloging output and average cataloging output was for a year. So I could turn around and not just say, you go tell the university librarian we've got this many feet of uncataloged books, because I don't think she knows what that means, but able to quantify it and say it would take us this many years to address this cataloging backlog as it stands now. And that number is much more understandable and digestible and scary. So this is one thing that we did is this data and the way that I communicated it to my supervisor, the way that she translated it for other administrators, led to a temporary cataloger position being approved. And it kickstarted some much more serious conversations about how we can address this need in a more sustained way. So those conversations are still ongoing. Another example is, well, I think we often think of making the case as getting new staff. Sometimes what we really need is to recast existing positions or lines to meet our real current and demonstrated needs. So using data to identify and address changing needs can be an extremely powerful tool in moving a program forward and solving operational issues. About a year and a half ago, our collections manager left her position. And in her exit interview, one of the pieces of feedback that she included was that she didn't feel entirely fully utilized and that maybe the work that she was doing didn't occupy an entire, you know, FTE line anymore. So we went back and we looked at some of the numbers that we had, some of the things that she'd done, her reports, and some of the other needs that we had in the unit. And we realized that looking at our accessioning numbers, there'd been tremendous growth in the amount of accessioning that we were doing, the collections that were coming in, and their size and scale. So we saw that, and we also saw that our archivists were spending an incredible amount of their time doing accessioning rather than doing some of their processing. So they're spending a lot of time on that, and it's impacting our overall processing output numbers. And that led us to rethink that collections manager position into a collections management and accessioning coordinator who could address some of the needs that we had as actual demonstrated pain points and that our numbers revealed to us. And that has proved absolutely transformative for our unit. Through deploying staff more effectively, we've been able to more than double our processing output over the course of the last year. And that's really just from streamlining and thinking about what we actually need. We've had some similar successes in advocating for adding additional processing space in our building. We had a recent project archivist start, and because we had the measurements of exactly how much space is required for a processing desk and for collection storage space, we were able to indicate to our administration that we could not accommodate that in our existing footprint without negative impact. So we got a temporary processing swing space for that staff member. So not all of our work can be measured, of course, and the measurements that we take are not always particularly meaningful for people without some mediation or translation, and that's a lot of what Jennifer is about to talk about. But Valerie Hotchkiss implored us this morning to know our audience when presenting our collections, and I think that holds true when presenting our data as well. And weirdly, I have learned that most audiences don't connect with detailed narrative reports about technical services written by middle managers. I know, I was surprised too. But, so I took some time and I kind of shifted the way that I do reporting out from my unit quarterly and annually. There is still a long detailed narrative report that pretty much only goes to my boss. Everyone else gets, I've put together these little infographic type ways of reporting out that kind of put things into a bite-sized, more digestible way for people to encounter and work with and see our data to communicate our successes using the data, but using it in a way that connects with more people and that is a little snapshot of what we do and is more appropriate for more audiences. So how we make and share this meaning and value that we're creating and how we turn our data not just into results but stories is a central part of the role of a special collections manager and especially a special collections administrator. We'll talk a little bit more about that now.
So picking up the thread of demonstrating our impact, I do want to talk a little bit further about the role of story. And so I think kind of bridge this session to the larger conference. Certainly in our work together as managers and in my own experience as an administrator, I found that the process of translating the data into meaning is ultimately one of telling a story, whether it's for an internal or an external audience, whether it's for operational purposes or advocacy purposes. So in this translation process, as I think of it, we are analyzing, we're inferring, we're interpreting, we're envisioning meaning from the numbers that we collect. We're also always mindful of the limitations of that data. So at the same time, we're also marshaling additional sources of information and anecdotes or anecdotal evidence. I liked the use of that term in plenary this morning. In this process, we're also typically creating some form of a narrative or a story that then communicates that meaning to others. So in our experience, we found that to do this translation from numbers to stories well, it's important to have a clear sense of audience. We've already heard that a lot today, and we'll hear more throughout this conference. It's important to have a clear sense of the purpose and message that you're trying to communicate, as well as the particular medium for the story that you want to tell in a given situation, because all of those factors can be different. It's also important to see beyond the data. So in the examples that Carrie spoke to in making the case for staff and space, our stories, and I do think of them as stories, took the form of formal written requests to library administration for a new temporary book cataloger, as well as for reconfiguration of the staff position we had. Our stories also took the form of verbal communication in recent feasibility discussions about the needs for staff and workspace that are part of a larger library master planning effort that's going on right now. In both of these cases, the stories that we told were grounded in the data that we had, specifically numbers about our holdings and our work, but they also of necessity went beyond the data. We were including more qualitative information to communicate more specifics about the ins and outs of our work, specifically in terms of preservation, security, access, and so forth. In some of the examples about decision-making that Carrie shared, our stories in that case took the form of the decisions that we made, the rationale behind those decisions, and the way that we communicated those decisions both internally and externally. So this is perhaps different from how we conventionally think of telling our story, but I really do see storytelling around our decision-making as in effect forming part of the collective narrative about our work. In this case, specifically about how we prioritize and how we make decisions about using our resources. And this, in turn, shapes our organizational culture, and it also informs our communications with one another, with our colleagues in special collections, as well as with administrators, stakeholders, donors, and users. In terms of demonstrating impact, our stories of necessity must reach beyond the data. So we're really looking, as we've already talked about, from turning the numbers about what we hold and what we do into stories that illuminate why it matters. So the processing and public services metrics that we collect tell part of the story, and they do this in terms of the numbers of items cataloged, collections processed, or in terms of the number of users served. So through comparative analyses of the data that we're collecting around this area, we've been able to leverage this data to do some assessment to quantify increase in productivity and services and demonstrate the overall growth in our programs. We've also leveraged that data to develop benchmarks for future growth. And so putting this data to use in this way, especially in our quarterly and annual reports, we're able to communicate important messages, such as the news this year that so far the collection services team has achieved a 80% increase in processing to date with 3 months left remaining in the year. So we are going to double it, which is a great message and an important one to share. I tend to think of these as data stories, and through such stories, we're able to communicate aspects of our value, such as return on investment, for instance, that are particularly relevant for certain audiences like library administration or certain university stakeholders. Yet even in reporting out in this way, the data stories are not themselves enough to explain the meaning of what we do. So in a recent example, when asked to prepare an annual report to date for the university librarian, which is in turn going to be shared with the new provost who's starting this summer, I made a point to supplement such data stories as these with narrative about the mission of the Rose Library, about the purpose and nature of our work across all of our different functional areas. And I did this as a way to help frame the value that we're providing to the university and to the community through the variety of resources that we offer in a way that might resonate beyond just what the numbers would allow. Beyond this, there's also a need for impact stories. And in this area, data really does fall far short. For instance, what does the number of items cataloged or collections processed actually tell us about the impact of these materials being available to the public? They don't tell us much, at least not on the face of it. It really does require a big leap from the numbers that we collect to a story that we can tell about impact. And that leap involves no small amount of interpretation and creativity. So to this end, we've been exploring with different modes of storytelling around impact. And one specific recent example is the chain of events that took place around a recent collection, the J. Herman Blake Black Panther Party Collection, which nicely highlights the impact of processing. So a brief story, the collection was acquired in 2016. It was processed and made available shortly thereafter. An announcement went out on Twitter letting people know that the collection was now available. There was a researcher who happened to be in town for another reason at that time, saw the Twitter announcement prompting him to make a special visit to the Rose Library to do research in this collection. Since then, the collection's been used by a number of researchers in the reading room, as well as by students in a number of different classes. In the last year, we also mounted a small exhibit of material from the collection, which the donor was able to come and visit, and himself had a really deeply moving experience with the exhibit and with his collection now housed in our library. And he shared a quote with us about this experience. It was one that moved him to tears. So bringing all of this full circle, In the recent issue of the Rose Library magazine that came out this past spring, we featured an article highlighting this particular collection and the impact of processing to try to share that to a broader audience. So this is one example of storytelling around impact, and I tend to think of these as being more data-inspired than data-driven. So to conclude, increasingly, we as managers and administrators, I think, are coming to see that storytelling forms an integral part of all elements of our practice, especially our data-driven practice. In order to communicate value, we need to turn our numbers about what we hold and what we do into stories about why it's important, why it matters. And we can think of this as a process of translation. While we tend to think of things as being lost in translation, I would suggest that in the context of data-driven practice, something crucial is actually found in translation, and that something is value. Value in terms of meaning and impact. And when I say found, I actually mean created, because we are in the business of creating value, and we do that through the resources we offer, but also through the stories we tell. So thank you for listening.
So we have some time for questions and comments. I'll just bring this over to the table for our panelists. Anyone?
Yeah. I have a question for the last presenters on tools they use for gathering data on processing.
Satisfaction with the instruction programs managed by everyone in this room, and what kinds of feedback have you gotten? Because that's something that I've been working on a lot at Iowa to get a sense of what faculty want. Are we meeting their needs? What kinds of learning objectives do they expect us to meet, and how are we actually addressing their interests and concerns? So
I can talk to you later.
Okay, cool. So not just like what classes are coming in, but are we actually?
We did a survey a few years ago that was fairly basic, but did get at that. Some of it was just, you know, how do you know about us? Some of it's getting an idea of where the sources were. Did you hear about us from someone else? Did you come in on your own? We also asked about the assignments they gave, and we asked generally about their overall experience and whether or not they were satisfied with the services that we provided. So that was a few years ago, and it was useful and helped. It highlights some interesting themes, but we haven't gone back to that. I think something we'd like to do in the future is do something along those lines where we actually talk about were learning objectives met and such. It's because we have a real wide variety of classes, some of which involve librarian participation, some of which don't, we'd have to work on it a little more. So in our experience, we've done something like that, but we could definitely do more work in that area.
And then did you do that through Qualtrics, or what was do you remember your mechanism?
We used SurveyMonkey. This was a few years ago. We also, EL has a Qualtrics account. We could have used that as well.
Okay, thank you.
At Houghton, we use a class request tool that we developed there. It's open source. Anyone can use it. And we collect the goal at the beginning of that request process, and then we do an assessment as a matter of course when we close out the class that's finished, so we can look at those things.
And I will answer with a short answer and then point you to my colleague, who I think you know. But yes, I think assessment is definitely on our minds as we're building and growing our instructional program, and I know that there have been efforts in the recent past to build that into work with specific faculty. So we have a wonderful instruction archivist, Gabrielle Dudley. She's here at this conference. I don't think she's in the room, otherwise I'll put her on the spot. She's not, so she can definitely provide more insight and detail.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, behind the post.
Hi, I have a question, two questions. First question, Joshua. For tracking the undergraduates in the reading room, was that students who were coming for instruction and students who came back to do research, or were they separated?
They weren't separated.
Okay.
Yeah, regardless of what brought them to us, yeah.
And then question for Jennifer. In terms of the interpretation work that you do with these narratives, how much time or percentage, or how would you describe how much time you spend on that interpretation work?
Not enough. So admittedly, I think I do. That is something that I, you know, still kind of grapple with. Don't have sort of a clear sense what's the best way to do this. It feels very fuzzy at best. So I would say, it's certainly not enough. But, you know, I think pulling together reports and stories, it can be, you know, anywhere from, you know, a half day's work to a few days, depending on what the challenge is. Everything else,
right.
But yeah, I think that's a great question. So really, what does it take to do these sorts of interpretations? What is possible? What are some of the questions to ask? How to frame that in a way that is both meaningful and efficient, and sort of gets you where you want to go.
As a quick follow-up, as you've been doing this work, are you finding moments in your donor interactions, in the events that you're doing, the exhibits, where you're now, you have a set of questions that, or your ears are more open for information? And writing the report, do you find that you're trying to build in ways to gather the story other people tell about us in a more, codified is the word that comes to my mind, but that's not really what I mean. So is it writing reports, or are you doing anything differently in terms of trying to figure out where to get those stories from?
It's making us start to ask those questions, because I think, you know, up until now, writing the reports is like, it would be great to include, you know, a quote from the donor, and we were lucky to have one in that case. It would be great to have, you know, some example here, and finding we don't have them to hand. So if you're thinking ahead as along those lines to be more proactive, you know, we're turning to that. I think all of our kind of collective attention is turning to that. The other thing I'll mention, and we didn't have a chance to talk through it here, but in terms of storytelling, we're thinking broadly beyond kind of the reports per se. Exhibits themselves are ways to tell stories, and that was something, you know, I had in mind as an example. But you know, again, there was a time, but thinking about the impact of research that's conducted in the spaces. We have, in a recent renovation in the last few years, built new designated exhibition space, and we have a piece of that space that's carved out to highlight what we call research and discovery. So it really is a rotating display of examples, projects, books, different products that resulted from research in our collection. So those are stories. I think, you know, there are other ways as well. The Rose Library Magazine, the communications like that, formal and informal, you know, how we're just kind of sharing these little tidbits. I love that. I mean, tidbits, and there are different ways, different stories we can tell in different mediums that we can tell. So it's not just the kind of structured narrative of a report. We really are, and it's really striking me just how much story is a part of everything we do. It's a conversation that you have in the elevator. It's, you know, a sidebar, something in a meeting. It's a, you know, cocktail, you know, chat over a cocktail at a reception. And you know, just the variety of forms of communication. So I think coming around to being more aware of that, I think it makes us be more effective and just more attuned to developing our storytelling skills.
Erin?
Erin Blake, Folger Shakespeare Library. Following on that, we are hoping to find ways of quantifying the impact of our collections on research. I love the idea of displays to show people what's been done. But so we are about to implement Aeon, and one of the things that we wanted to do is have our users include an ORCID ID, a unique identifier for the scholar, in the hope that, see, as an independent research library, we don't have faculty that we can be following. I'm wondering if anybody has tried that, if anybody has ideas for how this might work. We're right now thinking, well, we'll have these unique identifiers, and then we'll search the literature for mentions of thank yous of the Folger in the acknowledgments.
One thing you can try is actually, even before you implement the ORCID ID, is this tool import.io. Scrapes back data, and you have to futz with it a little bit to go through multi-page data, but you can hit up Google Scholar, Google Books, and pull back every time your institution is mentioned, and then you have a spreadsheet, really, of all of the works that you're thanked in. So you don't have to go through and crawl it by eye. You can use this little tool to do that.
What was the tool?
We actually have a Google Scholar alert I'm applying to. So we just have a Google Scholar alert set up, and I just plop stuff into a Zotero library.
Oh, clever.
Yeah,
and it's good when I come across something that they really use our collections. It's a good indication when, you know, they're an abbreviation. when your citation is an abbreviation in the list of, just BRBL. You know, and then those I, you know, forward on to our communications director.
What was the name of the tool you were talking about?
It's import.io. And that's good for retrospective stuff. So you can set up your Google Scholar alert going forward, but if you wanted to go back and look at things, that's what you'd want something like that.
We might have time for one last question. Seeing nothing, I release you to booksellers.